The Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Alaska.
Please be seated.
The Supreme Court is now in session.
Good morning. It's the time set for oral argument in the case of Myers versus Alaska Psychiatric Institute. I should let all parties know that Justice Carbonetti was unable to be here with us today, but he will be participating in the case. He'll listen to the tapes of the oral argument afterwards and will participate in the decision of the case. If you're both ready, then Mr. Gotson, you can begin.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. This case concerns the constitutional limitations on forced psychiatric medication under the Parents Patriae Doctrine. The trial court ruled there's a viable debate whether the drugs would actually help or hurt Mrs. Myers, yet determined that that was not relevant to the decision of whether or not to force her to take these medications because it was not a statutory criteria. We assert it is not constitutionally permitted to force medicate someone under the Parents Patriae Doctrine unless the court finds, in addition to incompetency, that the medication is in the best interest of the person, and that's a decision that the person would make if the person were competent. The facts here are simple. Ms. Myers presented overwhelming evidence that these drugs are neither safe nor effective. We presented those through qualified experts, one whom the judge find the credentials particularly impressive, Dr. Lauren Mosier, former chief of schizophrenia research at the National Institute of Mental Health, and Dr. Jackson, who he described as more knowledgeable about the effects of these medications than anyone he knew in clinical practice. We also presented below many studies that support these facts, that these drugs are neither safe nor effective. The state's response was basically, well, this is what everyone does. This is the standard of care. Again, the court found, as a matter of fact, that there's a viable debate over whether or not these drugs actually help or hurt patients, and found that there's a viable debate whether this should be the standard of care. Now, the state begins by arguing that the right of someone to be free from forced psychiatric drugs is not a fundamental right under the Constitution, but I really don't think that's a tenable argument at all. The United States Supreme Court has consistently held that in Washington v. Harper, Nevada v. Riggins, and most recently last June in United States v. Sell, that it's a fundamental right under the United States Constitution. I think there really isn't much question, at least in my mind, that the same would be true under the principles enunciated by this court under the Alaska Constitution as well, although there's no cases directly on point regarding psychiatric drugs, but there's some, there are cases that are similar. And really, how could it be any different? These drugs alter the very way that people think. They have serious side effects, can be fatal. There's a lot of evidence that they shorten lives. So I don't think that's really much in contention. But the fundamental issue in this case is whether institutional psychiatrist's determination that it's in that this should be done is immune from judicial review under the Parents Patriae Doctrine. I think that's the fundamental issue. And I do have to say, I cited State v. Sears in my reply brief, and in preparing for this, I discovered that the passage I quoted was from the dissent. So I think the logic and reasoning is good. I don't think it really, the dissent wasn't on that point, but I did want to point out that I did that. But I do think that it's very clear that the best interest conclusions are not immune from scrutiny judicial scrutiny under constitutional principles. Under these constitutional principles, as enunciated by this court, there has to be a compelling state interest, and the action has to further those interests. And in this case, there are really two purposes that the actions are aimed at under the parens patriae doctrine. One is that it's in the person's best interest. The other is that the state is saying, in this case, in the case of where someone's been found to be incompetent, that the person really can't decide for themselves, so we have to make the decision. So the purpose in making that, in invoking the parens patriae doctrine, is we have to make that decision. Okay. This court has also, of course, ruled as a general constitutional principle that in order to deprive someone of their fundamental constitutional rights, there needs to be no less restrictive alternative. Now, the United States Supreme Court, in the United States versus Sell case, recently addressed this case in the competency to stand trial context. In that case, in that situation, the governmental interest is to
Mr. Gossie, just a minute. I'm sorry to interrupt. Your shutter is loud and it's very distracting. Please limit your photography. Please continue.
Thank you. In that case, the context was competence to stand trial. So the governmental interest in Cell was to force this person to take medication so that the person could be tried, made competent, and tried for a crime. And even there, the Supreme Court held that the court must conclude that it's in the patient's medical best interest, it's medically appropriate, i.e., in the patient's best interest. Okay. Anyway, it's inconceivable, I think, that a person civilly committed, or even in the community, which isn't at issue here, has less rights to be free from psychiatric drugging than in the competence to stand trial case. Really, I think that it comes down to a very simple proposition, is that in all other contexts, people's constitutional rights are protected by the courts, and governmental interests are required. The government is required to prove that it's entitled to invade those rights. And if that's not true in this case, in this situation, then people that are diagnosed with serious mental illness have an exemption from the constitutional rights that everyone else is entitled to.
Thank you. Isn't there a big difference between Harper and Cells, or Cell?
Yes, in Harper, that was a situation where a convicted criminal was in prison. And in Harper, the Supreme Court very clearly limited it to that situation and said that, I may not be able to quote it exactly, but basically that in that situation, the governmental intrusion only has to be reasonably related to penological interests. And specifically held in other situations, the state would have to show much more due process. And in that case, it's very clear in Harper that that's exactly what the Supreme Court held. And I think historically the Supreme Court has granted much more deference in the convicted criminal in prison situation than in any other context. It's limited the amount of the rights of patients to really, seek redress in the courts and what due process is due in that situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gottstein. Mr. Hodgkin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Michael Hotchkin. I represent Alaska Psychiatric Institute. There's three issues that the court has to decide today. I'm going to state them quickly, and then I'll go back and go over each one in detail. The first issue is, given that citizens have a constitutional right to refuse medical treatment, what showing does the state need to make in order to override an incompetent and gravely disabled mental patient's interest in refusing psychotropic medication? In other words, what must be decided? The second issue, and I really see this as key to this case, is does the Constitution require that decisions regarding necessary treatment for incompetent patients be made by the courts, or may these decisions constitutionally be made in the first instance by the state's medical facilities subject to review by the courts? In other words, who may make the decision? And the third issue in this case is, if that treatment decision may be made by the medical facilities, in this case, did the hospital's procedures violate Ms. Meyer's constitutional rights?
And isn't there a second part to your second question, which is, what is the scope of that review? Is it simply competency, or is it also a review of the best interest determination?
Well, I think the competency is clear. That's in the court's realm.
Is it simply
already
that, or is it something broader to include the best interest of the patient?
I think your question, Your Honor, is what standard the courts may apply in reviewing the agency. Assuming the agency has the authority to make the determination in the first instance, what is the standard that the courts should apply in reviewing that standard? Is it de novo review, or is it arbitrariness on the agency's part in making the decision? Did that answer your question?
Just the way you framed it was, should the hospital be making the decision in the first instance subject to court review? But I think what the court is reviewing is the important part of that.
Correct. And the competency issue already, I mean, that's not for the agency to make. If the agency feels that the patient may not be competent to grant informed consent, they have to go to the courts for an order to administer medication. The only issue that's reserved to the court or to the hospital is the treatment issue of what treatment is appropriate for this particular patient. API's position.
I'm confused then. What's your position once a competency decision, once the issue of commitment?
If we look at what the roles of the courts and the hospital are under the statutes, the court clearly has to make the decision that the patient is mentally ill, as a result of that mental illness is either dangerous.
I guess what I'm asking is what parts of once the court decides that a person can be committed against the person's wishes, what's left for the court in deciding medication?
The state's
assume that all the bases to justify commitment have been established. What's left for the court to decide on the issue of
medication? First of all, whether the patient is competent to grant informed consent to the medication, and the state's position is that the court...
Is that a different test than the test for commitment?
Yeah, it's a different test. There's a lot of case law on that just because someone is committed does not mean...
How does it differ?
The courts have been moving away from a general incompetency determination to more of a specific test of competency or incompetency to make particular decisions. And the question of whether a patient is competent to grant informed consent to make their own medical decisions as to medication is a separate and carved out determination that the court has to make. And if you look at the definitions of informed consent in our statutes, it indicates what the court has to find to determine whether the patient is actually competent to make those decisions or not.
So you'll acknowledge that it's a substantially different test.
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't think it's
a substantially more rigorous test, isn't it?
I would agree it's a more rigorous test. But again, that's not the issue in this case.
Your brief seems to rely significantly on the factors that justify civil commitment as establishing the state's strong interest in medicating. Is that accurate?
The point of raising the issue that way in the brief was to counter the argument that was made in the appellant's opening brief that all the state needs to involuntarily medicate a patient is a finding that the patient is not capable of granting consent to the medication. And
I guess my question is this. If the statutes establish one test for civil commitment and then establish a second, more rigorous standard and separate standard for involuntary medication, then it's pretty clear, isn't it, that the state's interest in committing a person involuntarily doesn't establish a compelling interest in delivering involuntary medication. I mean, you can't argue that the fact that the person is committed establishes the state's interest in treating involuntarily, can you?
I think if you look at the way that the petitions typically come up and came up in this case, the medical professionals need to find in their petition for commitment that the proposed course of treatment will aid the patient if the patient is gravely disabled.
I'm trying to get at the nature of the state's interest here. What interest does the state have in treating a patient involuntarily?
The state's interest is in restoring a patient's ability to function independently. These patients, once they're involuntarily committed and the finding has been made that they're not capable to make their own medical decisions, the state, in one way or another, is going to have to make those decisions for the patients. And the state's interest is in taking a patient that's not competent to make their own decisions and who's been found to be not able to function and to restore their ability to function independently. Back to what the state would need to show in order to involuntarily medicate a patient. The parties actually agree, and that may not be clear from the briefing, but the parties agree that the treatment needs to be in the patient's best interests and that there's no less intrusive alternative treatment that will serve those interests in the same way.
Does the court make the second finding?
I think that both of those findings are up to the hospital to make.
Judge Kristen here made the least intrusive alternative.
No, I don't. Judge Kristen made a finding that there's a debate in the profession over the.
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the finding that Judge Kristen made in June on reconsideration, when she indicated that the evidence concerning CTC appeared to create the possibility of a less intrusive alternative, and on that basis ordered further evaluation.
And that is in the statute. If the court finds that there is a less intrusive alternative, that the patient has refused.
So that's a decision for the court. That's not a decision.
Well, I think that's a separate decision from. You're right, Your Honor. There is that component of the decision, but I think that the actual best interest finding, which includes, if there's a less intrusive alternative treatment available, then treatment with medication is presumptively not in the patient's best interest. So I think we need to key in here as far as the institution goes as to what the finding is, whether the treatment with the medication would be in the patient's best interest.
I just wanted to pursue that one step further. What was the final status of the case at the time of release? At least as far as I can determine from the paperwork in the file, it seems to me the last determination in the case was Judge Morgan's determination that there was a open issue about the least intrusive alternative, that reconsideration on that point was granted, and that further consideration of that point would be given, and with the case in limbo and in that fashion, Ms. Myers was discharged a short time later.
Ms. Myers, I think the finding that you're looking at actually went to an earlier. I don't want to call it a discharge. Ms. Myers was released for, I think, less than a day for less intrusive treatment and came back.
There was never anything to take the case out of the status of the motion for reconsideration being granted and further exploration of that issue being pending, was there?
Well, my understanding is that the ultimate resolution was a stipulation in front of Judge Kristen that Ms. Myers would be released against medical advice to pursue alternative treatment.
Okay. But before that stipulation for dismissal, there was never a resolution of the issue that caused the court.
Yeah, I think there was. Ms. Myers was released for purposes of pursuing that alternative, less intrusive treatment. It lasted less than a day in that program and came back to the institution because the alternative treatment found that it was not able to adequately treat Ms. Myers.
Is there anything in our record that indicates that? I mean, there's a brief reference to Ms. Myers coming back shortly after, but there's no explanation for why she went out and why she came back.
I am not able to answer your question on that this morning. Okay. Again, there's no question that competent patients may refuse medication. The statutes provide that the state will honor an incompetent patient's expressed wishes not to be medicated if the patient makes those wishes while she's competent. And the state has said the statute sets out the fact that the court may look at several items to determine whether the patient has stated wishes in that effect. I think that the question is that we agree that the treatment must be in the patient's best interest. Where we disagree fundamentally is whether the state must, in addition, substitute its judgment by attempting to determine whether the patient, if competent, and again, in the absence of the statutory procedures that allow the patient to express her wishes, would want the medication.
The substitute judgment issue, I think, is the last issue we need to deal with. But going back to the court's ability to review what's in the patient's best interest, it's my understanding that it's your view that's the doctor's decision to make and the court has no business second-guessing.
That's been changed, Your Honor. That was the position. The issue kind of arose in an odd fashion. Procedural due process wasn't raised in the appellant's opening brief. The state raised it kind of anticipatorily in the state's brief. It was responded to by Mr. Gottstein in his reply brief, where he cited the case of, I think, State versus Beans. And there's another case, K&L Distributors versus Murkowski, both of which indicate that, you know, if the challenge is to the constitutional violations on the way that the state reached its decision, then regardless of whether the statute allows or even explicitly does not allow judicial review of those decisions, that the courts can step in and review for constitutional.
Yeah, I don't understand that answer, so let me ask the question again.
Okay.
All right. What I understand Ms. Myers to argue is that before the state can involuntarily medicate her against her wishes, one, they have to find she's incompetent. Two, they need to find that the treatment plan of the hospital to medicate is in her best interests. And three, that this is the least intrusive means available. And then there's the fourth one, which is the substitute judgment. Let's put the fourth one aside totally and only look at numbers two and three, whether the treatment plan is in her best interest and whether it's the least intrusive plan available. Is it the state's position that that's an appropriate, yes or no, appropriate for the court to review those second and third prongs or not?
Yes, it's appropriate for the court to review the basis on which the hospital reached that decision. The court
so
should look at whether...
substantial evidence test. So you look at whether it's in the best interest and it's a substantial evidence test or rather...
The court should not review whether it's in the patient's best interest. The court should review whether the hospital used professional judgment in reaching that decision or whether the hospital acted arbitrarily.
So you dispute the court's ability to determine whether the administration of the drug involuntarily is medically appropriate, in other words, in the patient's best medical interest in light of the patient's medical condition. Is that correct?
That is a decision that the hospital's position is that that's for the hospital.
But isn't that an exact quote from Sell, which says that before the government can involuntarily administer antipsychotics, antipsychotic drugs, even where the state has an interest in making the defendant competent so that he can stand trial, that the fourth thing that the court's to look at is whether the administration of the drug, this is for the court to look at, whether the administration of the drug is medically appropriate, in other words, in the patient's best medical interest in light of his medical condition.
I agree with that totally, but Sell is a completely different situation. In Sell, the purpose of the hearing was to determine whether to medicate the patient to make him competent to stand trial. If you look at Sell, explicitly says that before the court should even reach that decision, you should look and see if the Harper procedures were followed. And if medication is justified under another rationale, as in the best interest of the patient, then what Sell says is the court should look to see if Harper was followed before the court ever gets into the question of whether it's appropriate to medicate the patient to make him competent for trial. So the state's position is that Sell is a different state purpose. It's a different set of procedures. But Sell, explicitly it discussed Harper over and over again. It relied on Harper as the basis for its decision, and it didn't make any indication that Harper was no longer good law, or that procedures in addition to those that are set out in Harper needed to be in place.
The court in Harper seemed to be very impressed by the rigor of the administrative review process to be followed by Washington State.
The court was looking
at... And there's no showing of any formal review process here. We're simply reassured that some process took some review of some sort took place.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and I would cite the court to the case of United States versus Charters, which is referenced a couple of times in the Appellee's brief. It's not discussed at length. That case deals with a situation more like what we have here, where there were no codified procedures for the hospital to reach its decision, and the court went through an exhaustive due process analysis basically on a case-by-case basis, and said that if the hospital used professional judgment in reaching its decision, that's when the court should be looking for whether the decision was arbitrary or not. Again,
did the court simply say it's a matter for state law?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the court there say essentially it's a matter for state law in the first instance?
In Charters?
Yeah.
Well, we have state law here. We have
right. So doesn't that bring us back to Alaska's Constitution?
I think that what we need to look at is the state statutes that we have in place and whether they are in violation.
But the question raises the constitutional question of whether our statutes are constitutional under the Alaska Constitution.
That's correct, but my position would be that Charter sets out the appropriate framework.
Charter doesn't say anything about what state constitutions required, does it?
It's a federal constitutional case. That's correct.
Well, right.
I mean, there's not a lot of state constitutional law out there.
There's a lot of state constitutional law.
Well, there's not a lot of recent state. I mean, the only case that's not a Medicaid prisoner for competency for trial that postdates the Harper case that's cited by Ms. Myers is the Ohio case of Steele. And I think if you look at that case, the issue in that case dealt with the competency decision. Who can make the competency decision? Is it for the hospital or for the courts? And the court in that case held that was a decision for the courts to make, and then kind of piggybacked onto that, and you need to make the best interest finding and all the rest in terms of a court, but never made the analysis as to whether those issues were more medical issues or more legal issues, whether they should be left up to the hospital.
You remind quite a bit in your brief on the comparison of this area to the law governing children, to protection of children. And in that context, the court makes the best interest determination, doesn't it? The court doesn't cede that area to the judgment of professionals.
I think that in the children's cases, the treatment issues are left up to the agencies, and the court is to review those for arbitrariness.
Before removal of a child from parents in a child in need of aid proceeding, or in a termination of parental rights proceeding, the court makes the best interest determination, doesn't it?
Yeah, but once a child is in state's custody and the state has the responsibility for acting in that child's interest, the court doesn't.
But you've already conceded that the test for involuntary medication is a different test than the test for institutionalization. So the legislature itself has recognized that there's a separate set of rights governs medication than governs institutionalization, hasn't it?
Yeah, but once the court has made the incompetency for medication question, then the patient is in the same position as a child under state's custody, and that the state has to be making those decisions for either the patient or for the child.
Wouldn't it follow from that logic that in a termination proceeding, the court wouldn't make the best interest determination? It would be only in the case where the child is removed from parents, the initial China proceeding?
I think we're getting a little far afield, but I think because the best interest...
I guess what I'm getting at is there's nothing at all foreign about courts making best interest determinations in areas where professional judgment is involved. Is there?
No, there's not. And generally that would be set out by statute. And in this case, the legislature has not granted that authority to the courts, but has vested it in the hospitals.
And the question is whether the constitutional requires the courts to exercise that judgment.
Our position is that judgment
because,
is vested
ultimately, the issue involves the patient's liberty, doesn't it? Not the patient's need for treatment.
I think it's a balance. The patient is
That balance is a balance that doctors don't engage in, is it? Doctors only consider the medical aspect of that question.
Oh, I don't think that's true, Your Honor. I think that in making prescriptions and diagnosing and prescribing treatments, the doctor has to consider the patient's condition, the patient's age, family situation. I mean, all that gets rolled. A doctor doesn't look at a patient as just a cipher. An 80-year-old man with cancer is going to be different and receive a different treatment recommendation than a 9-year-old girl with the same disease. I think the doctor has to consider the best interests of the patient in broader than just, is this medicine going to cause remission of the disease?
To what extent does your ability to win this case depend on your argument that the right to refuse psychotropic medications is not fundamental?
I don't think it depends on that.
Do you think even if it's a fundamental right and we find that the right to privacy would include not allowing the government to decide what drugs you take, that you still prevail? And that even under those circumstances, it's still not appropriate for the trial court or for the court in reviewing a decision to look at what's in the patient's best interest rather than simply what the doctors say and whether it's the least restrictive alternative available?
I kind of lost the thread of your question. I think that whether the interest is fundamental or not, the state has duties toward the patients. There are conflicting rights here. There's the right or the interest not to receive medication. There's the concomitant or competing interest in receiving treatment and in being rendered able to function independently. And the state has to balance those interests. I'm not sure if the fact that the state is inextricably intertwined with making these treatment decisions for the patient comes out, as I said in the brief, as to whether the right is fundamental or not, or whether it comes out into as what level the state needs to reach in order to override that right. But I don't think it's a question of simply the patient's right on one hand and the state's interest in overriding on the other. The state is inextricably involved in the patient's ability to exercise that right as the state would not be in the case of a competent patient.
Let me narrow the question a little bit. If it's a fundamental right, isn't there at a minimum a requirement for the least restrictive alternative available under our jurisprudence?
Yes.
All right. So if we find it's a fundamental right, at a minimum, that would be something for the trial court to determine, to review, whether the proposed medical treatment is the least restrictive.
I would agree with that. I seem to be out of time here. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess the first thing is if I would want to know if there are any questions that might have arisen. I think maybe the absent that clarifying kind of the procedure below might be a little bit helpful here. There were three separate petitions involved, but they're in the record that you were speaking about, Justice Brenner. But it's only the first one that's at issue here. There was a 30-day petition for commitment, and then a 30-day with an associated 30-day petition for forced medication. Then there was a little bit more than 30 days later, a 90-day petition for commitment with a 90-day petition for medication. But this appeal took place after the 30-day petition for forced medication.
But that was all part of the same proceeding, wasn't it?
Well, that's actually kind of an issue, but I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but that's, I guess, for another day. But this case came up an appeal from the initial 30-day order for medication. I was a little confused, too, about exactly what the state's position is, and I'm glad that was clarified. But it seems clear that they're arguing that the doctor's determination of best interest is not reviewable by the courts, and I think that's one, the fundamental issue at issue here, and courts review that in all kinds of contexts, and it doesn't seem to me there's any reason why that shouldn't be true here as well. And I guess I do want to discuss a little bit the contention that the state's interest is in making someone able to function independently. I mean, that's different than, that's not necessarily medical best interest. I mean, if someone is, you know, kind of so drugged out that they're zonked out in front of the TV all day in an apartment on SSDI, and that's all they do for the rest of their life because of these drugs, doesn't seem to me that's in a person's medical best interest. And what the evidence we showed was that 2/3 of the people who, if they're allowed not to take medication, they'll get better. Whereas if people get put on the medications, only 1/3 ever get better. I mean, get better. So what we're doing with this is we're taking people and maybe they're getting out of the hospital and into the zonked out states. But is that really in their medical best interest? And I think that's what the courts, that's kind of the fundamental issue. And here, Ms. Myers, I think it's very instructive to actually read her testimony, if you can, because she had, you know, very clear ideas about why she didn't want to take these medications. And it's not technically in this case because the court ruled that she was incompetent, but in terms of the concept of medical best interest, you know, someone might be having a psychiatric symptom such as hearing voices, and I think this gets to your question, Justice Brenner, about the difference between the commitment criteria and the forced medication and the best interest. And that's clearly a psychiatric symptom. But the side effects of the medication may be so abhorrent to the person that they would rather deal with those voices. In a lot of cases, of course, the medication doesn't even affect the voices. And this is in the record, too, in the Cohen critique, for example. So it really is a fundamental right for the person to make this decision. And I think it's also important to really understand kind of gradations of competency. If you look at here, it's not the situation where you have a feeding tube and someone can't express their desires. And the question is whether or not you remove life support or not. And under the Parents Patriarch Doctrine, do you remove the tube? Do you not remove the tube? We need to decide that. And under the Parents Patriarch Doctrine, it's what would the person want is what you really need to look at. Here, it's more like, I think it was a CDM case, where you had someone who was incompetent, retarded, and the question was sterilization. And this court said that even though the decision was, the opinions of the person was not determinative, the court should certainly look and see what that person's desires are. So I think you really have to be careful when you're looking at these incompetency cases outside of the forced medication arena that they really apply to the situation. Your Honor, I think if there are no questions, I think I'm done.
Thank you very much. If there's nothing further in the case, then we'll take the matter under advisement. We'll stand adjourned.